how can you have independent thinkers or creative thinkers or an amalgam of both and be systematic? It's not possible.
Welcome to Radio Free School.
Hi, I'm John Taylor Gatto. If you think just for a minute, the principal heritage in Canada, certainly the one that owns the country, is Anglican. And it's Anglican from particular parts of Britain, not the same parts as the mass settlement of the United States. I mean, the United States was settled by the dissenting population of Britain, the Congregationalists and the Presbyterians. But the Anglicans, or the State Church of England, is the principal influence on the culture of Canada. So there are huge differences between those theologies, but let me call them philosophies, since most people are unaware of the theological roots of this. The school had to cancel out the dissenting mind that was coming from Britain. It had to cancel that out by training children in habits of obedience. Not obedience to their parents, not obedience to their religion, not obedience to their traditions, but obedience to strangers hired by the political state. And once again, we're talking about major league radical here.
Scary.
Really is scary, because the ultimate purpose, once Darwin checked on to the British scene in the middle of the 19th century, the key was in hand to justify what was underway. Prior to Darwin, The Origin of Species in 1859 and his Descent of Man in 1871, prior to that time, you had to justify elites and differential behavior by religion. The Anglican Church teaches in its homily of obedience that God has ordained all these different levels of society, and that to want to get out of your particular position is sacrilegious. That's a pretty good straitjacket. But it was also protected by the police power of the state. You could use superior wealth to hire police who would subordinate, and then you would own the means of making a living, and you would only pass those out to people who were docile. So, but the United States didn't have that for a long time, except in the British-controlled coastal parts of the East. Over the course of a couple of hundred years, what grew up, and the same thing was true, of course, in Western Canada for a long time, I mean, prior to the telegraph and roads and cars and things, to actually reach out and fine-tune the life of communities was just impossible, except right near the large population bases. Mm-hmm. So quite a respectable, let me call it a libertarian population, occurred in both countries there. But gradually, with the rise of technology, easy transport, etc., that those libertarian elements were more and more marginalized. And then along comes Darwin, And what he teaches specifically, it's not an accident that Darwinism is probably the single great scientific truth, in quotation marks, truth, taught by schools. And it's taught in every school in Canada and the United States. Not because there's a massive scientific proof that it took place. There isn't. But because, as part and parcel of the universal theory of evolution, I'm not arguing against the theory of evolution here. I'm telling you what its social and political ramifications are. Darwin said quite explicitly that not everyone was evolving. In fact, only a tiny fraction of the population was evolving, about 5%. The other 95%, 19 people out of 20, were evolutionary dead ends. And in his second big book, Descent of Man, he spells out what will happen if you allow the good breeding stock, the 5%, to intermarry with the bad breeding stock, the 95%. He said plain and simple that evolution would march backwards into the swirling mists of the dawnless past. Now, suppose for just a moment that you were a wealthy drawing room lady, or I was a wealthy drawing room husband, and we were chatting about these exciting ideas coming out of England, and suddenly we realized that almost everyone around us outside the sanctity of that drawing room was a dead end, making eyes at our daughters and sons, right? Mm-hmm. Ready to send the human race back into the swamp. That the amusing thing is that responsible people who bought into those ideas, and you couldn't very well not buy into them, just as today you can't very well not buy into them without identifying yourself as some kind of nut, as soon as you accept that, it's part of your responsibility as a superior citizen to build safeguards into the society to make sure that the bad stuff doesn't mess it up for the good stuff. How are you going to do that? Well, you can't do it for very long with your army and your police force. Because basically your army and your police force are all bad stuff. Now, you can use them like a spot cleaner and on a fabric, some stains on it. But what you can't do is extend a non-stop police pressure on the population. You have to do what John Calvin taught the English in Institutes of the Christian Religion had to be done to get the damned to police themselves. Calvin was writing in 1635, you know, 370 years ago, 369. And he said these people have to be set against one another to police one another and to keep them out of the hair of the elect. Well, now, the theory of evolution is a secular theory, or so it appears on the surface. It's actually a different form of religious speculation. It says that a small fraction are elected biologically, and the rest are damned and dangerous. So how do you protect the good stuff from the bad stuff? Well, first you take the children away from the bad stuff. And you drill the children in forms of separation, of competition. You teach them not to trust one another. You teach them that they're in a deadly competition for livings in a very short time, that there's a huge dossier of numbers being accumulated, you know, that will dictate their entire future. It's all horse manure, but it's true if you believe it's true. It's just fascinating. I mean, there are, look, one out of every five wealthy people in Canada and the United States, one in every five is strictly working class. They managed to preserve the traditions that once you learn to do something that a lot of people wanted done, you could broker a service that delivered those kind of workers, and you could get just as rich as somebody who was the chief surgeon or the head stockbroker. That's true today, but you won't hear that in any school in the United States or in Canada.
Radio Frisco on CFMU.
I looked for a dozen years into the intimate details of colonial life over here in the Americas. And the minute you do that, there's abundant detailed evidence of the different way that young people were reared and the ability of these young people given back their minds to make radical successes, to be extremely effective in the political life of the community. You know, take the American Revolution, for instance. Virtually everybody who made the American Revolution was a teenager there. Now, Washington was the grand old man, I think he was 42 there, but Jefferson and Hamilton and really the whole pack of them were 17, 18, 19, 20, 21.
Wow.
They had been, you know, the boot and the myths that keep us small and in our place had temporarily been blown away, and they were able to overthrow the most powerful military nation on earth, huh?
Mm-hmm.
With, you know, barefoot people. It's
that kind of leads me to ask you. I mean, I don't know if you want to continue that, but I wanted to know what does it mean to be an educated person?
Well, isn't it ironic that question is virtually never asked? Where am I likeliest to find a concentration of educated young people that I can study and see what their goals are and what the goals of their coaches are. And then it dawned on me that the elite private boarding schools, the ones that carry on the tradition of Westminster and Eton and Harrow, there are about half a dozen over there, the ones here that carried on that tradition would absolutely be aiming to produce an educated managerial class to manage the rest of us dopes. So I began to study there are about 20 of them in the United States. I mean, there are hundreds and hundreds that claim to be, but there are about 20 that produce streams of powerful managers. Take the upcoming American presidential election. The challenger is from St. Paul's, which is 1, 2, 3 of the most prestigious boarding schools in the United States. And the incumbent president is from Andover. That's one of the top 10. If you go back to the last election, we have the incumbent president being elected, and we have his main competition being from St. Albans in Washington, Al Gore. That's certainly on everybody's top 15 list there. We also have John McCain, who represents himself as a man of the people, but in fact went to Episcopal, which is on everybody's top 5 list. Or we have Steve Forbes, who went to Kent, which was underwritten by J.P. Morgan. I mean, we're talking here about a populace that has been so numbed intellectually that it's incapable of responding to evidence that's right under its nose. You don't have to be a conspiracy theorist to say that in a nation of 300 million people, the United States, if two fraternity brothers from the same fraternity chapter at the same college in the same years were the opponents in the presidential election, that something awfully fishy was going on. And that yet is the case in the current presidential election. What's most exciting and depressing to me is that the press refuses to enlighten the public about the implications of that in a so-called democracy. How could that happen? Mathematically, what would a good London bookie put as the odds against that happening ahead of time? I think it would be billions to one. And yet we have that. I dare you to find anywhere on the radio or telly dial for the next week even a reference to that.
Right.
Wow. Mm-hmm. But to pull it back to school and why it's just essential to homeschool. So the schools are set up about 100 years ago to act as psychological conditioning laboratories, to actually train the mind or the character would be a dangerous, socially revolutionary thing to do. So schools don't do that. I don't think they're aware, the personnel, that they're not doing that. But the bells and the buzzers and the horns and the standardized tests are the way you train dogs or rats in certain habits.
Yeah.
I mean, that's it. So I don't want to hear that Barnaby South or North in Vancouver is the greatest school in the world and jammed full of high-tech equipment, it's got the same bells and buzzers and things. All of the rest of the stuff is window dressing.
Mm-hmm.
The teachers have, I would say, no positive authority. They have some negative authority that's substantial, really. They can constrain a kid from following a productive path. But they don't have the power vested in the job to encourage a kid along a positive path. Many of them, not half, but many, find ways to sabotage the system a little bit, you know, mm-hmm. and to treat their clientele as human beings with personal destinies. But if they're discovered doing that, you know, they're toast. There is no sympathy, and in most cases, no second chance. If the kids like you too much, you are automatically a fringe person in a school.
Is that what happened to you, though?
Well, it did happen to me, but I'm not a pushover, because I was raised in a Scotch-Irish community in western Pennsylvania, and I was basically taught how to fight, mm-hmm. how to defend myself, and how to inflict damage on other people. And the whole school apparatus is intensely cowardly. Although they can bully a mother at home or a kid in school or ridicule those people, they in fact have no seat themselves at the policy table. They're flunkies. They're relays in a system. And if they call attention to themselves, get their names in the paper for anything other than a charity drive, you know, that's the end of your career ambition if you're an administrator. And that's the beginning of your heavy surveillance if you're a school teacher. I mean, think of the structural nature of a system, any system there. If it isn't systematic, then by definition, you know, it's broken. Well, how can you have independent thinkers or creative thinkers or an amalgam of both and be systematic? It's not possible. It would assume that the one right way to do things had been discovered, and even someone of modest mental gifts knows that isn't so.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's just such a myriad of ways of doing things. The great teachers are the ones who are intensely observant and then immediately adaptable to the expression of one or another talent on the part of an individual. That the situation a homeschooler finds himself or herself in, unless they try to imitate the school pattern, which is all too often the case, but if they're generating an educational diet the way a scientist would generate hypotheses and then test them, they have to be superior to the best school in Canada or the state, the most prestigious scientific job in the world today. Nothing is even close to it. Is the head of the Human Genome Project. It surprised you to know that he was a homeschooler. And furthermore, he did not follow a balanced diet of a little history, a little science. The method used by his mother, who had three other boys, was that they all voted on what they wanted to study, and that's the only thing they studied until they got bored with it. And then they voted for something else. Collins is his name. He said in the New York Times about 4 years ago, he said, if the authorities had discovered what we were doing, you know, my mother would have been thrown into prison and we would have been parceled out to the social workers. Well, he didn't have any trouble getting into Harvard, and he didn't have any trouble rising through all the ranks of the well-schooled scientists to this position of awesome power. Of all the forms of homeschooling, unschooling would be my pick first and foremost. How you choose to spend your time, I think, tells you a tremendous amount about yourself. The admissions officer at Princeton a long time ago told me that the first thing they look at is hobbies. And I said, well, no, wait, standardized tests, grades, you know, volunteer service. No, we look at hobbies. And I said, why do you look at hobbies? He said, because it's really the only way a young person has an opportunity to commit to something without being, you know, pushed into it. So that the choices they make tell you really all you need to know as a college admissions officer about them. Well, he meant of an elite college like Princeton. And I said, so, like, what would it tell you? What do you want to see on there? He said, well, we'd like to see someone with an intellectual hobby, a social hobby, and a physical hobby. Wow, I said, like what? He said, well, it could be chess playing, could be ballroom dancing, and it could be swimming. I said, so what about sports? He said, it's got to be there. But he said, but people don't understand that individual sports like bike riding and skydiving and long distance walking and stuff like that, he said, are much more important than team sports. Huh, why so? He said, because team sports enable the individual to hide behind other people. You can slack off and let your teammates carry you. Whereas when you're out there alone, if you make a fool of yourself or if you're inadequate, there's no place to hide. And people willing to do that, he said, are superior people, and that's the ones we want at Princeton. I know the minute he said that to me, I saw instantly the wisdom of that, and I suspect you did too. So why aren't these ancient, well-understood truths the stuff of schooling? Well, the reason is because too many cooks spoil the broth.
What did you learn in school today, dear little boy of mine? What did you learn in school today, dear little boy of mine? I learned that Washington never told a lie. I learned that soldiers seldom die. I learned that everybody's free, and that's what the teacher said to me. That's what I learned in school today. That's what I learned in school. What did you learn in school today, dear little boy of mine? What did you learn in school today, dear little boy of mine? I learned that policemen are my friends. I learned that justice never ends. I learned that murderers die for the crimes, even if we make a mistake sometime. And that's what I learned in school today. That's what I learned in school. What did you learn in school today, dear little boy of mine? What did you learn in school today, dear little boy of mine? I learned our government must be strong. It's always right and never wrong. Our leaders are the finest men, and we elect them again and again. And that's what I learned in school today. That's what I learned in school. What did you learn in school today, dear little boy of mine? What did you learn in school today, dear little boy of mine? I learned that war is not so bad. I learned about the great ones we have had. We fought in Germany and in France, and someday I might get my chance. And that's what I learned in school today. That's what I learned in school.
The end.
I'm gonna wrap myself in paper. I'm gonna daub myself with glue. Stick some stamps on the top of my head. I'm gonna mail myself to you.
contact Radio Free School at grassroots@hwcn.org or mail P.O. Box 19, 1280 Main Street West, Hamilton, Ontario, Canada, L8S1CO.